Music has a special way of touching our hearts in ways many things cannot. And if you're tuning into this podcast, you probably think so too. On each episode of Classical Post, we uncover a creative mind behind music we find particularly exceptional. Coming to you from New York, Classical Post is created and produced by Gold Sound Media, a marketing and PR agency for the performing arts industry. I'm your host, Jonathan Eifert, creative director at Gold Sound Media, and I hope you find something inspiring in this episode. The architecture world lost a giant when the distinguished Uruguayan architect Rafael Vignoli died earlier this year at the age of 78. For four decades, Vignoli led his global architecture firm to international renown, bringing to life everything from airports to hospitals, sports stadiums, and performing arts centers, including one very close to my heart, Philadelphia's Kimmel Center. Having lived in the Philly area for many years prior to moving to New York, I've attended countless performances at the Kimmel Center. I've always been inspired by how the sprawling public space invites people to come together for drinks, conversation, and community, even if you're not there for a concert. According to Vignoli's son, Roman, director of Rafael Vignoli Architects, creating vibrant social spaces was always part of his father's mission. Outside of architecture, Rafael Vignoli had another passion, classical music. So it's fitting that a concert paying tribute to the architect's life and legacy is taking place next week at Carnegie Hall, where for decades, Vignoli attended several concerts every week. On November 28th, two ensembles that perform in Vignoli-designed spaces, the Philadelphia Orchestra under the direction of Yannick Nezet-Séguin and Jazz at Lincoln Center's Isaiah J. Thompson Trio, will share the stage at Stern Auditorium with violinist Itzhak Perlman and pianist Jonathan Biss for an evening of music honoring Vignoli. In this episode, Roman and I talk more about his father's life, the work the Vignoli Foundation is doing to extend Rafael's legacy in architecture and the arts, and how the Carnegie Concert also marks the first U.S. appearance of the Manet Vignoli Concert Grand Piano, an innovative, ergonomically designed piano Rafael helped create.
My name is Roman Vignoli. I am the director of Rafael Vignoli Architects, among other things. I collaborated with my father for on and off for 30 plus years, and was at his side full-time for the last 13, 14 years, working to try to help him get more stuff accomplished.
Can you provide an overview of your father's work at large, Rafael Vignoli, and the significance behind it?
Of course. My father was born in Uruguay and trained in architecture in Buenos Aires in Argentina, and had very great, very early success as a professional, and did all kinds of work in Argentina and South America until we moved to the States in 1979, where he established a practice, his own practice, which ended up doing work all over the world, became an international practice with a great deal of renown. He's done things, every single building type has been subject to his kind of architectural creativity, everything from bathroom renovations to airports and stadia, and everything in between, hospitals, convention centers, office buildings, performing arts centers, museums, private homes, etc. I think the most compelling thing about the way that my father practiced architecture may have to do with his upbringing in the 60s. In that period of ferment, of intellectual ferment, and especially in a place like Argentina that was so unstable and then suffered the dictatorship in the 70s. My father's approach to architecture, I think, was colored by those experiences. He looked at his work as something that invariably had a profoundly civic dimension. So his approach to the profession was to recognize that fact, to recognize that buildings are very capital intensive. They are very difficult to ignore because they're usually big. And they are relatively permanent things. So unless a building is in the middle of nowhere, those three facts make every project a civic project, even if it's a headquarters for a hedge fund manager, in the ultimate example, right? So he always found ways to leverage those enormous capital investments into developing public amenities. The ultimate example, maybe, is the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts in your hometown, Philadelphia. Originally, that building, when it was proposed, was to have two halls with two separate lobbies and combined back of house. And that's what most people would have done. My father's approach was to say, was really to question the idea of lobbies, of performing arts center lobbies as these very limited entities, right? They're things that are only used for about an hour before any performance. So maybe four or five times a week, they have life for an hour and then they have no life for the rest of the week. And he thought, well, that's an enormous waste of money. So why don't we take the two lobbies and instead of joining the back of the house, let's join the lobbies. Let's let the lobbies grow around the performing arts venues, Verizon Hall and the Perlman Theater. And let's throw an enormous glass barrel vault over it so that it's a grand, inspiring space that people want to come into and spend time in. And then let's populate it with restaurants and cafes and impromptu areas for people to meet and places for little bands to perform and fill it with life, basically 24/7. I think it's open from 8 o'clock in the morning until 11 o'clock at night, 7 days a week. So that's how Commonwealth Plaza came to be. And it does a lot more for Philadelphia than it would have in its original conception. That approach, that ethical, what I consider an ethical approach, really permeates his work throughout the world. In Argentina, he did a color television, the first color television studio. And instead of making it a typical box, he made the building a canted plane that flows out of a park so that the park would extend onto the roof of the color television studio with plantings and furniture and things for people to go up there and enjoy views of the city and be able to enjoy that extra space. So he created extra green space where there would have otherwise have been a very simple forbidding box. In Pittsburgh, he created a public park on the roof of the building as well and connected it to the street in a way that you don't have to enter the convention center in order to access it. In London, he created 20 Fenchurch Street, which has the only freely accessible viewing platform over the City of London that is also a park, which when combined with the green space that he was able to create on the ground floor, when you add those two green spaces together, it returns to the use of London citizens more public space than if the building had not been developed at all. These are the kinds of ideas that animated his work and his approach to the profession.
It's really incredible. I'm so impressed, and it's an honor to speak with you today because I, like you said about the Kimmel Center and me being from the Philly area, I had so many memories going to countless performances there over the years. And soon after it opened too. And I've always been inspired by this space. I mean, from the lobby to Verizon Hall to the Perlman, it's gorgeous. I mean, it's really, and when you think about how it stacks up against other halls, I think it's one of the best. I mean, I think it's just phenomenal. And that's not, and I didn't even, know the relationship of your father until today, when we're kind of connecting the dots here. But I think, yeah, my own experience, I think the building is amazing. So
what a cool
connection here to make.
I'm really happy to hear that.
Yeah, certainly. I know with Lincoln Center, they just did this whole renovation at David Geffen Hall. And I wish they could have used your father for that, because we were just at a performance. And I don't know, I just think Verizon Hall and Kimmel Center at large is just far more of a lovely experience than the newly renovated Geffen Hall. And it's crazy because they spent $500 million, you know, doing this, and it looks the way it does. So I so wish your father or your firm could have done that.
I appreciate it.
Anyway,
I'm sure my father would have wished he could have done it too.
it is what it is.
Yeah, it is.
And okay, so let's keep going though. I'm curious. So we have a big concert coming up at Carnegie Hall.
We do.
And so I'm really curious to hear the whole backstory about this, but specifically this, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Manet Vignoli Concert Grand Piano.
Yes.
Do you want to give us some backstory with all of this?
Sure. So my father is a lifelong musician, was a lifelong musician. When he was 8 years old, he discovered a pretty serious talent for piano. And it was something that really attracted him as a career path, until he learned a bit more about the difficulties of that profession. You know, he thought that architecture would be a surer bet. So he decided to pursue architecture, but playing the piano and listening to music and going to concerts was always his favorite pastime. It was his refuge from all the pressures of his professional life. So in practice, that manifested itself in a couple of very specific ways. The first is that he always had a Steinway Concert Grand at easy reach. His office is right next to my office. The next office over is a sound isolated room with two Steinway D's in it that he would go and play, you know, for as little as 5 minutes and for as long as all day, depending on what was going on around him. Our relationship to Carnegie Hall was a very strong one, and he had tickets to every performance at Stern Auditorium, and he went two or three times a week. Seriously, like at least twice a week, he was in the audience at Carnegie Hall. So when my father died suddenly, unexpectedly, back in March, it hit me like a bolt of lightning that the most appropriate way to celebrate his life, and he was a very accomplished person who did a lot of good in the world, I think through his, well, you're proof of that. The way you feel about Kimmel is proof of that. So it struck me instantly that the way to celebrate his life would be to indulge in the things that he loved the most. And what he loved the most was classical music in a wonderful hall. If we had lived in Philadelphia, it would have obviously happened in Kimmel, and we're planning to do something in Kimmel as well. But we live in New York, and the majority of our friends are here in New York. All the people that worked with my father are mostly here in New York. So there are a lot of people coming from all over the world. And I thought the Philadelphia Orchestra on the stage of Carnegie, perhaps even with Jazz at Lincoln Center, another venue that my father designed with Wynton Marsalis, who is very happy and proud of the venue that they've created. I don't know if you've been to Jazz, but that's a very interesting story too. And so I knew that's what I wanted to do. You know, I knew that I wanted to gather as many friends, family, coworkers, and partners in that place and have a wonderful concert. At the same time, since 2016, my father and I, in partnership with Chris Mane, a really wonderful piano builder in Belgium, have been developing what I believe, and I have yet to find anybody who can convince me otherwise, but what I believe is the first true evolution of the concert grand piano since Steinway crossed the strings in 1851. You know, the piano is an instrument that had a long period of constant innovation, improvement, you know, before it was a piano or it was a clavichord, and then it, you know, it started growing, and from two octaves, it went eventually to 7.5. But the keyboard stayed straight, and people's arms didn't grow with the piano. They stayed the same. So the inspiration for the project came from my father's experience as a pianist and his own experience of the physical exigencies of creating good sound, right? The way that the force is transmitted through the keys into the instrument is something that depends a lot on the relaxation of the kinetic chain from your shoulders down to the pads of your fingers. So when you reach out to the edge of the keyboard, you introduce indirect force vectors that make it more difficult to play. It's as simple as that. And then one day, so this is something that he thought about all his life, how to relax. And he was a very highly strung person. So relaxing at the piano was something that was a constant challenge for him. And then one day he was friends with some really legendary musicians. He was good friends with Maestro Daniel Barenboim, and he was good friends with Marta Argerich. And they were having dinner one night in Berlin after some concert at the Pierre Boulez at Barenboim's house. And they were all complaining about the difficulty of achieving pianistic excellence, right? And my father said, yeah, wouldn't it be great if the keyboard was ever so slightly curved so that when you reach out to the ends of the keyboard, it responds ergonomically to the way our bodies are built, as opposed to not responding at all. And they looked at him, and he was a very enthusiastic person always believing that things could be done, never saying no. I think they saw that passion and they encouraged him to do it. Barenboim had a straight strung instrument built by Chris Mane. And he said to Raphael, well, you know, you should go talk to this guy. He built me this amazing straight strung piano. He had been inspired because Barenboim had played a replica of Liszt's piano, which was a straight strum before Steinway crossed the strings. And so my father went to meet Chris Mane in Belgium, and they hit it off. They decided, okay, let's do it. Let's figure this out. So then began this long process. It took about a year to get to a finalized plan, design. Wasn't just that the keyboard was curved. It's that if the keyboard is curved, then an architect like my father would then take that original notion and extend it organically to the rest of the instrument. So if the keyboard is curved, then the strings should be radial. If the strings are radial, they fan out over a much larger soundboard. They create much more sonic separation between one note and the other, which in the hands of an amateur is a more challenging thing, right? Because we rely on the harmonics of the cross strings to blend the sounds. But in the hands of a master, it's an extra set of tools that allows them greater capacity for nuance on top of having greater capacity for power, because you literally have a soundboard that is about 30% bigger than a Steinway D. So we built the first instrument, and we took it to to Baron Boehm at Pierre Boulez, and he sat down and he played it. And he said, oh, the ergonomics are terrific. I like it a lot, but the sound isn't quite right. And of course, you can't, you know, you'd never have a second chance to make a first impression. So we said, all right, back to the drawing board. We corrected some experimental things that we had tried to do with the soundboard and built a second instrument. Took a year more. So we went back to Pierre Boulez. We put the second instrument in front of Meister Baron Boehm, and he played it again. And he said, oh, much, much better. But there's still something missing. It was a little bit like, it was like a Woody Allen movie, you know? Just something missing. So we said, right, back to the drawing board. And when we were there in Berlin, the chief piano technician of the Berlin Philharmonie said to us, hey, can I take it into my shop and futz with it? And we were like, yeah, sure, knock yourself out. So he took it and we went back. We started building the third. About 6 months after this technician, a brilliant technician named Thomas Hubsch, about 6 months later, I received an email from a wonderful pianist who had played it. And he said, I'm so grateful that I had the chance to try this instrument. I believe it's a wonderful gift to our community. And I would love to play it again. And I said, yeah, sure, that'd be great. But then I called Thomas Hubsch and I said, hey, what the hell is going on? How come I'm getting a call from this person? And he said, oh no, I've been inviting everybody in Berlin to come and play the piano and they love it. Everybody loves it. He had, you know, worked on the hammers and changed some tensions and changed a few things. And he had really brought it up a level. We took it back to Baron Boehm and he said, yeah, this is a great instrument. That is the piano that was debuted publicly by Kirill Gerstein last summer at the Verbier Festival in Switzerland, which I went to with my father and my wife and my daughter. And I'm so grateful that he had a chance to experience that. It was very well received. The piano really is a magical instrument. And it's that same instrument that's going to be played at Carnegie by Jonathan Biss, who will play Beethoven's Fifth Piano Concerto, The Emperor, on it with the Philadelphia Orchestra and Yannick Nezitsky.
Amazing.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it really is. A question for clarity, 1 second before you go on. So this final version of the piano, was this number two, but improved by this German guy, or was this number three that the German guy improved?
No, number two was improved by the German guy. Number three came out already wonderful.
Okay.
And it's not the final piece. You know, part of what we believe and the way that we're approaching this project, you know, it's a passion project. We're never going to compete with Steinway. We don't want to compete with Steinway. What we really want is for Steinway to take the project and really, you know, give it the amplitude that we think it deserves. And Steinway is the right company to do it. They're the people who basically made the piano what it is today. Our approach is there's always room for improvement and we're going to keep tweaking it and we're going to keep evolving it. And in fact, the number four instrument was just completed. It's cross-strung. It's an experiment. We said, look, okay, we have the straight-strung thing is working great. Does this make sense in a cross-strung configuration? It's a little bit more conventional in terms of its playability. And so we tried it. And it was just recently completed. It was finally voiced and tuned and prepared. And, you know, when a piano first is born, it it gets voiced, and then it has to be played and tuned and played and tuned and played and tuned, so that it sort of settles into its mm-hmm. final, you know, character. I haven't heard from anybody other than the people at the workshop at Mane Pianos. They are the exclusive Steinway dealer in the Low Countries, and they've made replicas and rebuilt historical pianos. So these people, they know from pianos, right? And they've all told me that it's the greatest thing they've ever heard. Even better than our straight strung version. Different, not better, different, but with a very, very long sustain and great power and still this amazing clarity. I haven't yet heard it because it just happened and I haven't been able to get over there to hear it. It's going to be played in December at the Beaux-Arts in Belgium, in Brussels. And we're really looking forward to that. It seems like a very exciting development.
Yeah, that's very exciting for sure. So in terms of, and we'll get to the more concert details in a second, but in terms sure. of the piano and its future development, and even, I don't know, hitting the mass market or anything like this, or like a dealer, yeah. like a Steinway dealership, or, you know, a separate dealership, are there plans or a vision for anything like that? Or is this simply like a, you know, handcrafted, you know, one-off pieces that are so rare and that's that?
No, we're definitely going to keep building them. You know, there's people who have already come to us and asked us to build them a piano, and we're happy to do that, obviously. The most important thing to me is, you know, we don't want to force this down anybody's throat. We just want people to try it. And if they try it and they like it, then they'll want to play it. And if they want to play it, then we'll have to build more. That's the idea. Mm-hmm. If more people try it, like it, want to play it, and we have to build more, eventually we'll have to find a way to make that happen. Our partners, Mane Pianos, has no interest in being a huge producer. They're more like an R&D shop. They're just artists, you know, amazing artisans who are deeply passionate about evolving this instrument and learning everything there is to know about how you build a better piano. So we're going to find, if the demand is developed, then we'll find a way to make it work.
Yeah. Well, it's exciting. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
For sure. But I mean, I love the whole concept. I think it's really it's cool, and also the story of how it developed. I didn't realize that, especially with Barenboim being involved. I think that's quite a seal of approval that you have there. That's quite nice.
it's been great. You know, I have a video of Manuel Ax playing it for the first time, literally for the first time, and he sits down at the piano, and he plays something, and then he turns and he looks at the camera and he goes, it's actually easier to play. You know, it was like that.
Nice.
couldn't have asked for anything more than that. But yes, it's easier, but it's also a great new tool for the world's greatest pianists. That's really the idea.
Indeed. So let's pivot here for a second. And last question, actually, and that's talking about the actual concert here at Carnegie Hall.
Sure.
Can you discuss a little bit more about that? I'm reading here from my notes. It celebrates the work of your father, Raphael Vignoli. So I guess the big question is, what do you want people to take away after attending this really significant event?
You know, it celebrates his life more than his work. One of the things that affected me deeply since his passing, I expected people to express admiration and respect for everything that he did. And, you know, if you look online, you'll see where he built all over the world, and really amazing things. So I expected admiration and respect. I wasn't prepared for the for the depth of affection that was expressed for him. And people really loved my father. They loved his energy, his optimism, his can-do attitude. They loved his creativity, his sense of humor. And when he died, we're not a religious family. And I didn't want that expression to be mediated through a kind of sad and melancholy service in a funeral home or anything like that. I really wanted it to be upbeat because my father had a great life. He did, you know, it's not a tragedy. It was tragedy for me that my father, my closest collaborator and a person who I dealt with literally 24/7, suddenly disappeared from this earth. But he went out how he probably would have wanted to, you know, with his boots on, working without having to suffer the worst ravages of age, you know, and declining capacities and all of that, which I think would have been very difficult for him. So I wanted it to be a celebration. So that's really what it is. It's a way for people to gather who loved him and knew him and respected him and admired him. And worked with him to share a moment of lightness, of light, really, a moment of light and art. The other thing that I wanted to accomplish with this concert is to introduce a foundation that we've created in honor of my father and in order to extend his legacy. So that was the second thing that was very clear to me soon after I learned of his passing, was that I needed to dedicate a good portion of my energy to trying to generalize my father's ethical approach to the profession. You know, this notion that every investment in the built environment is a civic intervention is something, is a value that I think is very worthwhile cultivating in our society. And I think the way to do that is to support architects who are trying to develop public realm components in their work. So we plan to do that with grants and professional support through a professional network that we're building. And in this way, and through awards to, you know, to really recognize the work that has some genetic connection to the work of my father in these examples that I mentioned to you before and many others, which if you look him up, you'll see. So we wanna push the real estate development ecosystem towards recognizing the value of engaging the civic realm, the public realm. We think it makes buildings more valuable on top of more valuable to people. We think it makes our environment more supportive of communities and more supportive of individuals' well-being. You know, when you walk into the Kimmel Center, you feel a certain rush of endorphins when you see that enormous barrel vault and you experience that space that's made for you. You know, it's not made for the ticket holder, that it is for that person too, but it's made for the citizens of Philadelphia. So we want to push the real estate development ecosystem in that direction. And the other thing we want to do is we want to pull it into that direction as well by doing something that my father and I talked about for many years, which is to develop a curriculum of early childhood education to inculcate in young children a critical understanding of the built environment. And, you know, that's something that very few people outside the design professions really have any training, right? And yet it's one of the most impactful things, right? We're conditioned by the design of the space we wake up in, the design of the street we walk down to go to the subway, the design of the subway, the design of the place we go to work or the school we go to study, and then the design of everything else that we experience in our lives as urban creatures, right? So we're subject to the design thinking of people that came before us 100% of the time, and a very small portion of the population is able to say, well, those proportions make sense, and this circulation pattern is coherent, and I feel good in this space, or I feel bad in this space for this reason or that reason. So we wanna make investments in little kids to try to get them to understand how to think critically about the spaces that they inhabit, so that when they become adults and they learn of a project that's coming down, you know, on their block or down the street, or they stand at a ballot box. Yesterday was election day. They stand at a ballot box in front of a ballot question that has to do with some zoning law, right? They can express their own real will about how they feel about that. That's a really long-term project. But I think a beautiful one, because, you know, kids love to play with blocks and build forts and do all of that stuff. And we just want to take those instincts and channel them into a broader understanding of the spaces that condition their lives. So that's what the Vignoli Foundation is going to do. And this concert is on top of a celebration of my father's life and on top of the US premiere of the Mane Vignoli concert grand piano. It is also the launch of the Vignoli Foundation, which is intended to take these ideals that animated my father's work and make them more generally a part of the way that cities evolve in the future.
Yeah. Incredible. Well, it's very impressive. I mean, that's, there's a lot happening here at Carnegie Hall that night. It's a very impressive night. So why don't you tell our listeners the date again and who's performing?
Sure. So it's November 28th at 8 p.m. at Carnegie Hall in the Stern Auditorium, Ronald O. Perlman Stage. It's with the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Yannick Nezet-Segun, the artistic director of the Philadelphia Orchestra. And it features special performances by Itzhak Perlman and the Isaiah J. Thompson Trio, curated by Jazz at Lincoln Center. Unfortunately, Winton couldn't be with us because he's on tour in Europe. So he sent this wonderful musician, Isaiah Thompson, who will play a short set. And then we're going to bring it all home with Jonathan Biss, wonderful American pianist and a great interpreter of Beethoven, playing the Emperor Concerto on the Mane Vignoli concert grand.
It's so exciting, the lineup of artists that you've secured. I mean, it's not every day that you can kind of hear all of these people in one, you know, spot. It's sometimes reserved for these like opening galas, you know, sometimes. Yeah. I mean, especially when you have Itzhak Perlman and Yannick and Philadelphia Orchestra. I mean, it's very much over the top. I love that. I think it's fantastic, but it's kind of quite a lineup.
Yeah, the only person missing is my father. You know, he would have loved, and of course that's the idea, right? We wanted to do something that above all he would have loved, and I'm sure he would have loved this evening. And
I'm sure.
Hoping that everybody that shares it with us will love it as well. I hope you'll come. Will you come?
Yes, I'm planning on being there.
Great.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And again, I'm sorry for your loss. You know, that's very devastating, but it's such a beautiful tribute to your father, you know, with this concert coming up. And I appreciate you, you know, taking the time and discussing all of this today. I think it's been really fascinating to learn all of these different things about the background of your father, but just the legacy. And I think that's really critical. And especially with the foundation, I think that's really meaningful. And it sounds like you all will do a lot of good in the world. And that's meaningful.
We're very excited. And I'm very, very grateful for the opportunity to talk to you about all of these things. I really am.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Classical Post. If you loved it, give us a 5-star review as it helps us reach more people. Also, remember to hit that follow button in your podcast app to get notified of new episodes.